You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning. I'm Darrell West, Vice President of Governance Studies and Director of our Center for Technology Innovation at Brookings, and I'd like to welcome you to our forum on mobile technology. And for those of you who are following on Twitter, we have set up a hashtag that's TechCTI, so you can pose comments or questions through Twitter if you would like. So the number of smartphones worldwide has increased this year to more than 1 billion devices. Mobile phones are being used to improve education, healthcare, and entrepreneurship around the globe. And given the growth of mobile, we are this morning wanting to address the topic of what American policymakers should do to respond to this accelerating revolution. Where are we going to get more spectrum in order to enable wireless applications? What can both the public and the private sectors do to stimulate greater innovation and investment in mobile technology? To help us understand these issues, we have two outstanding speakers, one of whom actually is here. The second one, Senator Pryor, will be arriving, and I will introduce him when he arrives shortly. But we're very pleased to welcome Randall Stephenson to Brookings. Randall, as you know, is the CEO of AT&T. Since becoming chairman and CEO in 2007, he has transformed the company into a global leadership position in mobile internet services and IP-based business communications solutions. Under his leadership, AT&T has dramatically expanded its U.S. wireless business and enhanced its advanced enterprise capabilities. The company has expanded its fast-growing UVerse platform for integrated television, data, and voice services. AT&T also has initiated the largest education initiative in the company's history, AT&T Aspire, which is a philanthropic program designed to help college and career readiness for students at risk of dropping out of high school. So, Randall, welcome to Brookings.
Thanks, Darrell.
So I think we'll start the conversation with you. As the leader of a major telecommunications company, how do you evaluate current telecommunications policy, and where can we do better?
I guess this is probably going to surprise people, but if you were to do a scan around the globe on public policy concerning our industry, you would probably have to conclude that the United States has the policy that has been, I believe, the most pro-competition. It has been, by a long ways, policy that has driven the greatest amount of investment in this industry, more than anywhere in the world. It is probably, not probably, it has driven the greatest amount of innovation in this industry of anywhere in the world. And then there are a number of places where you could point to demonstrate that. I really believe the place that stands out most readily and most apparently is our policy on spectrum. And it has evolved rather significantly over the last 5 or 6 years. But what we have done in this country from a spectrum policy standpoint, getting more spectrum airwaves out to the market, putting it out into the market in a fashion that the people who buy it or that license it treat it like an owned resource, and we are exploiting our spectrum in this country more than just about anywhere else in the world. And I give a classic comparison. I've been spending a lot of time in Europe. And in Europe, you're not seeing mobile internet technology take off the way you have in the United States. And one of the key places I point to, they're obviously economically in a very difficult situation, so there's probably some lack of investment that you could attach to that. But I believe primarily you attach it to the spectrum policy in Europe. And it is a policy that tends to, it's obviously different by country, which is another issue, but it is a policy that tends to give short-term licenses, shorter term, it's all relative, but 8 to 12 year licenses to the carriers. And when you have a license for a limited period of time, you think differently about how you invest into and exploit that technology. And so as a result, you look at what's happening in the United States to mobile technology versus Europe, and Europe 6 years ago was the leader. Europe today in the developed world, unfortunately, is probably among the bottom in terms of developing these technologies. The United States, I believe, is at the top in terms of developing these technologies.
So you mentioned the spectrum issue. So the FCC has proposed a new incentive auction as a way to free up additional spectrum here in the United States. How should that auction be structured, and what are your expectations in terms of how it will go?
Well, I would hope that it's structured consistent to how it's been done in the past. And when you've had the type of success that we have had in this country, one would ask why you would change it too much. And what we have tended to do in this country is the regulators have set... Here's the senator. Welcome, Senator.
Talk about a big entrance. We like that. So.
How you doing? Good to see you.
So we'll get you mic'd up.
You want me to continue while they're mic'ing him?
Yeah, why don't you continue? So we are talking about spectrum and the new incentive auctions.
And so just from a policy standpoint, what we have done in the past is the FCC, the regulator that oversees this, sets caps in terms of how much spectrum should any one carrier be allowed to hold. And that has served fairly well over time. But now I will tell you, over the last couple of years, there has been another policy is overstating it, I would say a practice by the FCC, and that is that the FCC has combined this with, they've been far more efficient at dealing with secondary market transactions in spectrum. So somebody holds spectrum, they're not going to put it to work, and so allowing companies to trade and sell and buy and sell the licenses to this spectrum have basically facilitated ensuring that this spectrum is constantly being moved by market forces to its highest and best use. And that's really, really an important aspect to this. And you have to pair that with really, really strict build requirements so that somebody cannot just go acquire spectrum, sit on it, hold it, and house it on a speculative basis. If you put those three policies in place, spectrum caps, what is kind of the government's policy on how much spectrum any entity should hold, number one. Number two, good, efficient secondary markets is just absolutely critical. And then really stringent requirements on building out into the spectrum within certain limits of time.
So I'd like to bring Senator Pryor into this conversation. Senator Pryor was first elected to public office in 1990 as a member of the Arkansas State House of Representatives. So we know he's smart because he's survived Arkansas politics for 23 years now. In 1998, he was elected Attorney General, where he toughened the laws against drunk drivers, enacted legislation to protect children on the Internet, and prohibited unwarranted telemarketing calls. He was first elected to the U.S. Senate in 2002 and re-elected in 2008. He serves on six different Senate committees, including Appropriations and Homeland Security and Government Affairs, among others. And perhaps most importantly for this conversation, he chairs the Subcommittee on Communications, Technology, and the Internet, where one of his major priorities has been in helping rural communities meet their growing infrastructure needs. So, Senator, just to pick up on this theme of spectrum and what we need to do in order to get more spectrum so we can enable greater mobile applications in the future, what do you think we need to do on spectrum policy?
Well, we've been having a series of what we call state of hearings in the subcommittee on the what we call CTI subcommittee, Communications, Technology, and Internet subcommittee. And we're having a total of four. We've done three of these. We've already had our wireless hearing. And the reason we call them state of is because we have probably 30 to 40% of the subcommittee is new to the subcommittee, in some cases new to the Senate, and we're trying to give them kind of an overview, a snapshot of what's going on out there in the telecom world and the Internet world. But also we are trying to give us a chance, the other members of the committee and even the community at large, to hear kind of where some of these new senators are coming from, because a lot of times we don't know. They're kind of a blank slate in terms of some of these issues. But one of the things we talked about in the wireless hearing was spectrum, spectrum, spectrum. It seemed like every time, whatever issue it was.
It was probably me.
No. Whatever issue it was, we kind of kept coming back to spectrum. Obviously, that's the name of the game when it comes to wireless services, is you have to have adequate spectrum to do this. So lots of pieces of this that we talked about, and again, we did talk about some unlicensed spectrum issues, which are important. We talked about the fact that the government owns a lot of spectrum right now, mostly Department of Defense, but others do as well, some of the intelligence agencies and a few other agencies here and there, and kind of how we may transition some of them off and how you do that in the right way. And one of the things that we did We actually had a classified hearing in the full Commerce Subcommittee a few months ago, and it was classified with DOD and the intelligence agencies and a few more in there to talk about kind of what they have. One problem there is we don't have a great inventory of what all they have and how they're using it. So, you know, there's some baby steps here we got to take, some building blocks to know kind of where that's going. But one of the things that came through in the classified hearing was that just as there's more and more and more seeming a never-ending demand for spectrum and more gadgets and gizmos and uses for spectrum in the commercial sector, private sector, you're seeing that same phenomenon with our military and with our intelligence. They are using more and more of it. They're much more interactive. Things are much more wireless and much more mobile and global and all these things. So anyway, this is kind of background to answer your question, but I think when you talk about spectrum, there are lots of pieces to it, but I think that what the chairman said here is that there are some basic criteria that you have to do to get it right, and we need to get it right long-term. And again, if we're going to ask, for example, in this case, if we're going to ask the Department of Defense to move off an area of spectrum, that's a big deal. They have a big investment in infrastructure there. They have a big investment in technology. They have handsets. They have, you know, all these missiles and, you know, drones and all kinds of things that are using this spectrum right now. So we'll work through those issues, but I do think it's critical that we get this right. And we also need to find ways to make our use of spectrum much more efficient. We need to try to maximize the use of spectrum. And kind of where I see it is like you're growing up in Oklahoma, I'm growing up in Arkansas. We had all the spectrum in the world. We had no use for it. We had no idea what it was good for. We kind of thought maybe one day we might need it or something, but nobody ever really thought about it. Now it is an absolute premium. And what we're doing is there's kind of this almost never-ending set of ideas on how to use it and gobble up more and more spectrum. And we need to understand it is a limited resource, and it's a huge, extremely valuable national resource. And there are very good reasons why companies like AT&T want to get certain blocks and certain bands of it. And again, these are a lot of good reasons, but we just have to do it in the right way. And I think that's one of the things we got in the hearings, is that different people, very well intentioned, but they may come down on different sides of some of these issues, and they have good rationale to do it. So FCC, Congress, whoever, we're going to have to kind of sort through some of this.
Okay, one more question for the senator. So you mentioned the importance of getting it right. So on the new incentive auctions, how should those auctions be structured, and what's your sense of how they're going to go?
Well, I think that here again, for example, I can't remember the names right now. We had two different witnesses that talked about this specifically in our subcommittee hearing a week or two ago. And basically, one, for example, said that we should allow the larger companies to come in and buy these huge national, I don't know if you call it tracks of spectrum, what do you call
footprint.
It? Footprint. Huge national things. And again, lots of good reasons why you would want to do that. And his conclusion was that's how the government makes the most revenue off the auctions, and we're trying to pay for FirstNet, et cetera, through that. So, you know, his rationale was this is the right policy, it's the right way to go. Then we had another witness come in, another panelist come in, and he basically said, no, this needs to be more regionalized, more, you know, smaller blocks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's how you maximize the revenue. So, look, again, both of them made their case. At the end of the day, someone's going to have to make that decision and, you know, be the referee on that. And I'd say that it's probably going to be the FCC with a lot of congressional input.
It's kind of interesting, especially listening to you, because I think you're spot on. And we were talking, making comparisons about the U.S. versus Europe, for example, in spectrum policy. And I think you nailed it, and that is, what is it you want to accomplish? That will dictate what you do with spectrum policy, right? I mean, if what you want to accomplish is maximize the revenues to the U.S. Treasury, that may be a very, very different structured spectrum auction than one that says, we want the absolute lowest prices possible for the end user consumer, right? Those could be two very different answers. And if you want an answer that says what is really important to us is that the U.S. not only maintains but extends its lead in terms of innovation, development, and exploitation of these resources. That leads you down a very different path. And so I think the senator's right on that we have to ask the question, what is it you want to accomplish? And then you just structure a spectrum
and
option around
part
that.
Part of that is competition. Of course, it's a hyper-competitive world right now. But there are ways to structure spectrum where theoretically create more competition or less competition.
Right.
And those, a lot of those are judgment calls.
So. Yeah.
So, Randall, there's been a lot of attention lately to the National Security Agency and the request for metadata from telecom and Internet providers. Google, Facebook, Microsoft, and Yahoo have called for greater transparency in the national security-based data requests from the federal government. Should the government allow companies to publicize the number of phone records and Internet data requests that they receive?
Should they allow us to?
Yes.
I mean, I'm glad the senator's here. It's probably a question for a senator to ask.
I'll ask him, too.
That's what I was afraid of. As a rule, we obviously don't comment on matters of national security. Now, that said, you think about all the things we have been talking about here already, just in a very short order, and how, if you go further in terms of how we envision all of these technologies to be taken advantage of by the consumer and by businesses and so forth, we are motivated. We want everybody using these devices for every functionality conceivable to mankind, right? We actually anticipate 5 years from now that your primary identifier in the marketplace will be your mobile phone number. As you conduct commerce, as you identify yourself and enter buildings, we believe the mobile phone number will be how you're identified. And so I go through all that to tell you that from our standpoint, one of the most important things that we have to achieve as an industry and as a society is that the consumer and the business has a high degree of confidence around privacy and confidentiality of the data that is traversing and going in and out of these devices. So I start with that. That is a really high priority for us as an industry. Now, we do. You've read about it in the paper. Everybody that's even attached to this industry from time to time will get subpoenas or court orders for information. And so we strictly, very strictly comply with those orders and warrants. But I really can't go much further than that.
Well, Senator, your views on this?
Well, let me just say this. I think that, a few years ago, some of the companies came in and talked to me about this very issue. It was another context a few years ago, but they were looking at possible liability for complying with these court orders. I don't think we ought to put our companies in that position. A lot of this was after 9/11. That was the context of what we talked about before. These companies felt their patriotic duty was to comply with the court orders, and when the various federal agencies were coming and said, look, we need your help, we're trying to prevent terrorism in the future, these companies, by and large said okay. And then they turn around a few years later and they're looking at massive amounts of liability. So I don't think it's fair to put them in that position, and I've tried to help on that over the years. At the same time, with all that said, any of these programs that we're learning about, that NSA and others run, we have to be extremely careful. We need to make sure that our court system works and that there are very, very compelling reasons why these agencies would want access to that data, and that we need to make sure that there's a lot of integrity in that process. And it was interesting, after this, The Guardian made this story public, pretty much, I can't think of an exception, maybe there was an exception, the members of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, both Democrats and Republicans, all came out defending the programs. Again, a lot of this is when you really get inside the programs and know what they're doing and know what's really going on, you get more comfortable with it. And sometimes the headlines don't always tell the whole story. And I know the president's been very aggressive in defending the policy as well. So it's an ongoing discussion we're having in the Senate. I'm sure we're going to have some hearings. I know that the Intelligence Committee has made arrangements for any of us who want to sit in on not just their classified briefings, but deeper and in a classified setting, explanations of these programs that's been made available to us.
Okay, why don't we open the floor to some questions. The senator will have to take off in about 15 minutes. I don't know. He has his job, I guess, on Capitol Hill. He needs to do. Now, we have a question over here.
Not and
if you can give your, if you can give us your name and your organization.
I think the FCC is wrestling with that right now. Again, we're talking about that in a subcommittee, in the full committee level, in the Senate Commerce Committee. I have not made a decision on that. I want to see where the FCC comes out on that. I hope to and plan on having lots of input and lots of discussions as we go through this process, not just with FCC. Obviously, that's important, but with stakeholders to make sure that we get this right. And I do think the FCC wants to get it right. But I'm going to tell you, it's hard. You know, one of the things that, you know, spectrum is one thing, and it's extremely important. But these policies that we set have long-term ramifications. And in a little different context, I had someone come in my office the other day, and they said, hey, we need to rewrite the Telecom Act of 1996. And I said, all right, tell me why you think that. And he said, well, because if you read the Telecom Act of 96, the Internet is only mentioned twice, and the whole battle back then was long distance versus local. And that's just, we've moved way, way beyond that. And I said, well, okay, I hear what you're saying, but if you think about the amazing innovation that's happened in this space, the amazing competitiveness, the technology, the deployment, all these things. I mean, it's just been an off-the-chart success. Why do we want to go in and rewrite this law? It seems like it's working pretty well. So the same thing with spectrum. You know, you want to be careful that you're not limiting these companies from innovating and investing. You want to make sure in the end you're not hurting consumers by making it more expensive or limiting choices or whatever. So it's really, there's a sweet spot in there somewhere. I think everybody's trying to find it, and I hope I'll be part of that solution as we do try to find it.
I obviously, if I could, just would respond as well. I keep coming back to what do you want to accomplish with the auction, and what is your motivation? And I know one of the key motivations is money into the United States Treasury, and to the extent that we have an auction where two of the players who would have the most interest in participating are excluded or limited, arithmetically, you're going to affect the amount of money that the Treasury yields from the auction. I would also say those who come in and bid the highest are going to be, just by market dynamics, those who have the greatest need for the spectrum. And so it's not as though the rules are set up such that if one company were to go acquire a bunch of spectrum, it's affecting the competitive dynamic. They're going after it because they need it, and they will put it to work. And there are strict build requirements on this spectrum, so somebody is not just going to be housing it. Now, go back again. 2007 was the last big government auction of spectrum. The two companies that people talk about they want to inhibit from competing for the next auction are the two companies who went and acquired the most spectrum in the last auction. The two that people would like to see get most of the spectrum are the two companies that did not even participate in the last auction. And so, you know, inhibiting a couple of competitors from bidding in the hope that people who haven't even competed in the past might come in and try to buy the spectrum feels like a big gamble for something that's so important as a big spectrum auction like this.
Okay, there's a gentleman right here on the aisle who has a question. There's a microphone coming over. And again, if you can give us your name and organization.
Sure. Phil Goldstein from Fierce Wireless. Randall, last month at a investor conference, you were talking about innovation in data plans, and you were talking about the prospect of content companies defraying the cost of their content by either paying carriers or doing some kind of advertising. People have since, before that comment and have said, well, big content companies like, say, ESPN that have the money to do that could do that, but that would give them a leg up on smaller content companies. So that might run afoul of net neutrality principles and regulations. So my question is kind of twofold. When do you think those kinds of plans might be commercialized? and how do you think they would stand up to net neutrality scrutiny?
So think about how the mobile internet world is developing. And mobile internet technology is unique from a telecom technology standpoint. And what I mean by by being unique is it doesn't scale like the way telecommunication technologies have in the past. In the past, you go run a strand of fiber, and it's kind of a step change capital requirement and a step change cost structure, right? And so you go run a strand of fiber, and you've got a lot of capacity for a long time. It's a very fixed cost investment for a long period of time. In the world of mobile data, you add 1 megabyte of data capacity, there is a direct and immediate cost that goes with it, a capital requirement and an operating cost that goes with it. And so as the data requirements continue to go up, the costs kind of, they track with it. I mean, there are efficiencies and productivity gains, but it's basically more of a less scalable technology than what we've seen in the past. As a result, the pricing has followed those economics, right? So the pricing tends to be more usage sensitive. Now, there are a lot of companies. I fully expect market forces will take you to a place where a lot of companies say, you know what, I would like for XYZ customer segment, market segment, to be able to access our content. They might be more inhibited to use it because there's a direct and immediate cost to the consumer by virtue of this pricing. So maybe we would like to do something where we help defray the consumer's cost to get them to come access our content, our website, our application, or whatever. This is no different than what you saw happen in the 70s when long-distance costs were the same way, and companies like Sears and Roebuck and J.J. Bean and so forth developed 1-800. We developed 1-800 services for them. They said, we want you to come and buy things from us. I tell you what, we'll pay for the long-distance call to get you to come and do business with us via the telephone. Why will you not expect that same thing to happen on the mobile internet? As you have billions of people accessing it, why would companies not be interested over time in seeing a model like this develop? That said, we have developed for application developers APIs where they can access into our network, and they can take advantage of this today. That capability is there. Anybody who wants to do it, any application developer who wants to do this, can absorb some portion of the cost of the consumers so that they can access their content, and we'll see. We'll see if it evolves at all. I don't know. I would be surprised if these models do not evolve. I don't see any net neutrality issue. It's open and available to all comers if anybody wants to take advantage of these technologies.
Other questions? Here on the aisle. There's a microphone coming over right here to you.
Hey, I'm Howard Buskirk with Communications Daily. I wanted to ask you a follow-up question, both panelists, about the incentive auction, because in my world, that's the main thing people are talking about these days. There have been a lot of questions, everything from the 600 megahertz band plan to how much buy-in we're going to get from the broadcasters. You know, we don't even know who's going to be making, you know, some of the final recommendations on this in terms of the FCC staff. And I'm just wondering, how certain is it at this point, from your perspective, that the incentive auction is going to be a success, or is there still a big question mark hanging over it?
Go ahead. You want me to go first?
Go ahead.
I haven't a clue. I would say the success of the auction will depend upon the questions we've been debating here. What is the structure of the auction? And you made a very important point. If you really want to raise revenues, and particularly from the government standpoint, enough revenues to pay for a public safety network, a really hardened public safety network, then you not only have to have a structure that incentivizes people to come in and buy and pay up for the spectrum, but you also have to have a structure that incentivizes people that own the spectrum to bring it to market. The FCC is playing an interesting role here. They're kind of like a broker. They're matching the sellers of the spectrum, the TV broadcasters, and the buyers of the spectrum, which will tend to be the wireless carriers. And so to the extent that the auction is structured in a way that a really large number of TV broadcasters don't bring their supply of spectrum to market, then companies like AT&T or Sprint, T-Mobile are going to look and say, the senator made this point, look, for this to be useful to us, we need kind of a broad footprint with a certain amount of depth, because that you scale the technology that way. The service quality is really important, that it be broad and deep spectrum. And so if you don't get enough broadcasters coming into the marketplace, putting their spectrum in there where companies can acquire these really broad footprints of spectrum, then the auction will fail in and of itself. So getting the auction structure right is critical to make sure you have people with supply and people with demand coming to meet and bringing the revenues to the table.
I do think that it all depends on how the FCC designs the auction. I think that they want to see it be a success, and I think they have a lot of motivation to make it a success. I think they have to weigh lots and lots of different factors. You know, one of the things that I think is just true about this, and this is one of the question marks that no one knows the answer to, and that's why there's anxiety about it, is if you really look around the country, we talk about this spectrum crunch. Really look around the country, there's not a spectrum crunch in most areas. I mean, Randall.
Today.
Today. And I would say that, you tell me, 35 states really don't have a spectrum crunch. If there's a problem with access to wireless communications out in where I live, it's probably more just infrastructure build out and the economics of providing it, because it can be very expensive in rural America. But there's definitely a spectrum crunch in some areas of the country, and there will be more and more so around the country. So, you know, one of the questions is where you need the spectrum the most critical need is in the urban areas, right? I'm guessing those broadcasters, that's a very valuable asset for them, and they may be the least reluctant to give up their spectrum. So, you know, how the FCC tries to design this and structure it to put in place all the right incentives and get all the policies right, we just don't know the answer to that yet. But like I said, I'm going to be hopefully heavily involved in this all the way around, not just talking to stakeholders, but talking to the FCC and listening to people all around the country to try to make sure they get it right. So, I mean, there's still a question mark about it, though.
There's a question right here.
I'm Danielle. I'm a law student. And this is a question for both of you, also with regard to the incentive auction. Senator, you mentioned earlier that one of the reasons the 96 Act has been fine as is because we have so much innovation. So if one of our primary goals is innovation, then with the incentive auction, shouldn't one of our primary goals be fostering competition?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's good. And that kind of goes back to what Randall was saying a few moments ago. You know, depending on what your goal is, that sort of starts to dictate how the auction is going to be structured and what you're trying to accomplish with the auction. And then also, some of that depends on what you mean by competition. You look right now at the two largest carriers, they are extremely competitive with each other and with everybody else in the industry. I mean, look, it is a hyper-competitive industry and has been for a long time. One of the ironies of this, by the way, just on a local level, is Scott Ford, who used to run Altel in Arkansas. It got gobbled up by Verizon a few years ago. Now Scott's on your board.
On my board.
So, very, again, Scott is hyper-competitive. You know him. He is a total entrepreneur, total capitalist. I mean, he's great. He's great. But he's now sitting on their board. But the point is that I guess some of that depends on how you define competition. And you need to look long term. There's lots of different aspects to competition in this area, and I know there are some that kind of get down in the weeds about, you know, how, you know, technically, almost mechanically, contractually, how things work out there. So these guys are huge competitors. They believe in competition. They're not afraid of competition. They live in it every single day. But I do think competition is good. I think you've seen the net effect of competition, and it's led to a ton of innovation, tons of investment, really making the U.S., it's one of the strong points, one of the great success stories of the U.S. economy in the last 25 years. So,
I would argue, I think he said absolutely nothing I disagree with, and I would maybe go one step further, and that is the competitive environment in this industry. The U.S. mobile industry is as intensely competitive as anywhere I go in the world. And you can determine how you want to measure that. But, is it utilization of the services? Is it technological leapfrogging in the industry? Is it pricing? in any of those dynamics, it is the most competitive in the world. I know of no place in the world where you can go and between $0 and $200 walk out of a store with a $600 iPhone. I don't know anywhere else in the world you can do that. I compare the U.S. to Europe, and just mobile voice minutes of use every month. The average in Europe is almost at 200 minutes of usage a month. In the United States, that number is bordering on 1,000 minutes of use per month. Then the dynamic on data utilization is exactly the same, and the price per megabyte of data in the U.S. is among the lowest anywhere in the world. And so this is a hyper, hyper competitive environment. Now, to talk about structuring an auction that incentivizes greater competition, you can, if your objective is to drive prices and services to low commodity levels. If you want just low price commodity services, we got a model for that. It's in Europe. And you can go look at what that looks like. You can look at how that feels from an innovation and from an investment standpoint. And it is not what I would think is the model that we in the United States would like to attach ourselves to. So, again, limiting competition in an auction to incentivize greater competition in the marketplace, those kind of don't reconcile in my mind, but your question's a fair one. And but I got to tell you, the model as it's been derived in the U.S., and if it's great foresight and planning by the policymakers, I take my hat off to them. If it was luck, I celebrate luck, but it is the best in the world right now.
Okay, Senator, I know you have time pressure and you need to take off, but thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. I wish I could stay longer. Thank you all. Appreciate you. It's good to see you. Thank you. By the way, Eddie Grilling does a great job for you. Thank you.
And we're going to continue. Yeah, you need to leave the microphone because that's our microphone. we're going to continue the conversation with Mr. Stevenson. Right here's a question. If we can get the microphone over to this young lady right here in the second row.
Hi, thanks very much. Alina Selyuk with Reuters. I wanted to follow up on the national security, everyone's favorite subject. You say that reassurances to consumers that their private data is safe is a very high priority for you. I can tell you that despite the fact that the news was focused on Verizon and particular internet companies in the recent days, most people out there are pretty much spreading that across all the companies, and there's talks about you guys being involved. What can you tell consumers right now about the privacy and security of their data? Can you reassure them that their information is not being provided in bulk to the government, or how else can you show them that you're seeking more transparency on the subject?
Yeah, what I can tell you, again, these are limited at what we can and will say on matters of national security. I'll just reiterate, privacy and security of data is critical to us, but we do, from time to time, receive subpoenas and court orders for information. We comply with the law in fulfilling those orders. So to the extent you go beyond that, that becomes a public policy debate that I think we have to engage the senator and like-minded people on.
Back there's a gentleman with his hand up. Right there.
Yes, Rob Lieber from AFP. Can you talk about the process, still on the national security issue, the process, and are you comfortable with the process, and are you comfortable with how much control you have over how your company is able to respond to that? As a CEO, are you in control of the responses to national security?
I'm comfortable with how AT&T responds to subpoenas and court orders for information, yes. I better be.
Right there's somebody with their hand up.
Hi, Duan Nam from U.S. Korea Institute. I'm just wondering whether you can talk about maybe telecommunication market in Asia. You talk a lot about Europe. I'm just wondering, that is there something that's competitive about Asia market or something that U.S. companies can learn?
Yeah, it's Asia is a it's a really fascinating one. Asia, I would say, rivals the U.S. Some would say Asia is well ahead of the U.S. in deployment of these new fast mobile internet technologies. We're deploying the same technologies. Asia, as for example, Japan, is much more broadly covered than the United States of America with these technologies. Fortunate or unfortunate for the Japanese, the population density is like 30 times greater than the United States. So covering 1 million people in Japan takes a lot less infrastructure than covering 1 million people in the United States of America. But we all, if you would go and evaluate the really dense urban communities in the United States, everybody's the key Asian markets, which I will make Korea and Japan. We're at comparable places. Now, you are seeing the Asians begin to exploit the capabilities far more dramatically. I think they're a little bit ahead of us in terms of mobile commerce and some of these types of applications. But in terms of deployment of the technology, we are in very comparable places. In terms of innovation around the technology, I think we lose sight in the United States oftentimes of this gem that we have developed out in Silicon Valley. Because the innovation surrounding all of this technology is highly, highly concentrated in California, specifically in Silicon Valley. And the amount of capital, the billions of dollars of capital that is now focused on applications and capabilities and exploiting this technology is off the charts. It's really, really impressive. And so Asia, there's some great things, there's some great learnings, but, you know, the key markets in Asia and the U.S. are in very comparable places right now in terms of deployment.
So, as you know, President Obama has nominated Tom Wheeler as the new head of the Federal Communications Commission. So how do you expect the FCC's approach to change with a new leader, if at all?
So many of us have known Tom. He's been around this industry for a long time, and he is a big brain. He's a progressive thinker. He understands this industry. I suspect Tom and I don't agree on every policy issue, but I expect it to be a very fruitful FCC. I think it'll be an FCC that you see begin to move really critical issues forward. He's spoken and has written about things like the IP transition, for example. AT&T, we are deploying IP technology across the United States. And in fact, our objective is, we have laid an internal objective, that we will sunset. Our objective is to turn off our legacy, we call it TDM technology, POTS, plain old telephone service. We expect those services to be turned off in 2020. Sounds like a smart thing to do, right? All telephony needs to be moved to IP or wireless. Voice should be IP voice or voice should be wireless, but there is really no technological or market-based reason why the old legacy services should be in place. Now, for us to do that requires a significant amount of regulatory approvals. There have to be rule changes that would accommodate us turning off old technology. And we in the industry sometimes talk about that we cannot have a regulatory environment that actually locks us into old technology, and that is what we have today. Tom has written about this, and I actually have high expectations of Tom's energy surrounding this and being able to move this issue forward and move our country down a path towards all internet protocol and all wireless technology. So I'm energized by Tom coming in.
Okay. Other questions from the audience? Other people who haven't asked a question yet?
Right back there.
Oh, right there.
Thank you, and thanks for another great program, Daryl. Bill Jorn with ROI3. We'll be developing apps, content stuff for developing countries. So my question relates to that to some degree. The senator talked about spectrum crunch, maybe not in other areas of the world, but I do know that talking with some people like in sub-Saharan Africa, there is a question as to whether or what effect the spectrum auction in the United States will have in terms of its effect over in other countries, actually, and particularly with the introduction of the smartphone in so many areas and such things as the cable along the western coast of Africa, you've really got a growing connection between telephony, data, and internet. If you could comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. Make sure I understand your question. But the key means by which the United States spectrum auctions and public policy can affect technological innovation and deployment in places like sub-Saharan Africa is creates a model. And if I were a policymaker in sub-Saharan Africa and I were interested in deploying these technologies and getting spectrum into the hands of people to exploit it, I would look around the globe and I would ask who got it right and who got it right by what criterion. And the criterion, if I were in sub-Saharan Africa, would be I want the broadest penetration of these services possible, and I want the broadest investment into this spectrum as I could possibly achieve. And I would suggest, from a developed market standpoint, the places I probably would not look if I were making this decision would be India. I think what you're seeing in India is development of the technology that is achieving the first part, which is broad-based penetration of the services at really, really low commodity prices and very, very low quality. But you're not seeing the next level of innovation that's going to be required to bring all the benefits of this. And what I mean by that are education and healthcare benefits that are derived by these wireless internet technologies. And to get the education, the healthcare benefits that are derived from this, you need the high-quality bandwidth. And a low-price voice commodity service will not get you there. And so I think they're going to have to move away from the Indian model and probably somewhere closer to either the Mexican and maybe towards the United States model to achieve that. And I got to tell you, when you think about developing markets, the opportunity for these technologies to drive education to a completely different level is one of the most exciting things that I have been attached to in my career. And we made an announcement 3 weeks ago. This is just an example of what this can do and what it can do to the cost equation. Because my frustration with education is that the cost routinely does this. Daryl and I were talking. It's the only area in the United States economy that's been exempt from the productivity magic of the last 20 years, because cost is doing this and quality is going nowhere on education in the United States. We combined with Georgia Tech and a company called Udacity, and 3 weeks ago announced that Georgia Tech will be launching a fully accredited program degree in computer science, master's in computer science, which today costs $40,000. Next year, we'll be introducing this fully accredited degree for $7,000. I think $7,000 is high, but we can debate that, okay? But we're going to introduce it for $7,000. If a technical credential degree like that could be introduced at a 20% of the cost type environment, why can that not be moved downstream into engineering and undergrad? Why can it not be moved into secondary education, primary education? And why can that not be exported to sub-Saharan Africa and begin to introduce the highest quality education programs in the world into these developing economies? To me, this is world-changing. This democratizes education, and it is a major, major deal. It's a big deal.
Right there. Microphone's coming over.
Hi, I'm Anne-Marie Kovacs. I'm with Georgetown. How are you? We've talked a lot about wireless. Could you talk a little bit about video and how Uverse and your video platform are doing?
Video is the game, okay? If you look at, by the way, video is a wireless-derived impact as well, because when you look at our wireless networks, Maria, it's a third of the volumes on these mobile networks now are video. And if you move it into the fixed line side, it's even higher. Video is driving the broadband era right now. We go out 5 years, that number is dramatically higher, and video is what's driving that. And it's not just your traditional, what we think of as linear streamed video, you know, ESPN or NBC and whatnot. It's a whole new world of video, and it's user-generated content. It is communication. Person-to-person communication, video chat. This, we believe, is what drives the industry for the next 5 years. In fact, we are actively working that over the next 5 years, we will fundamentally change our network engineering and criterion around being video delivery as the basis for how we engineer the networks. It's a huge item. And we think this is what's going to drive the spectrum requirements over the next 5 years. And we are just on the very beginning of this. So as you begin to think about peer-to-peer video chat, this is comical, but it gives you an example of where this goes. My wife sent my son-in-law to the store recently to pick up something. As most men will do, they get there and don't really know what it was they were supposed to pick up. And so he puts my wife on FaceTime and says, "Is this it? No. Is this it? No. Is it? That's it. Got it." Okay? That's a silly example. But I believe that utilization of video in day-to-day, minute-to-minute interaction, not just a video chat like this, but this type of application is going to be massive, and it's going to be huge in education as well. So it's all about video.
Yeah, that grocery store example would work in my household, too.
It's effective.
Other questions? Back there, gentleman with his hand up.
Thank you very much. Ian Worthen with CEB. And your annual report talks a lot about creating a denser network. And I was wondering
Density.
And I was wondering if offering more AT&T Wi-Fi in private buildings, kind of like this building at Brookings, would help provide kind of a seamless AT&T customer experience, so I'd switch off the wireless and switch on the Wi-Fi.
Yeah, so I'll answer your question directly. Yes, it is a huge priority. If you are an AT&T fixed-line customer, or if your company is an AT&T data customer, we have deployed Wi-Fi in your building, you auto-authenticate. If you're out on the wide area network and you're on a data session and you move into a building that has Wi-Fi in it, it moves. It auto-authenticates. You don't have to go and say yes and get that obnoxious little client that pops up and said, you know, do you want this data connection? Does it in Starbucks. If you've authenticated in Starbucks, you walk into Starbucks, you auto-authenticate. And so that is the world. And now, that is really important. That densifies the network. We're moving to small cell technology to densify the network, meaning that rather than big cell sites with huge antennas sitting on top of them arrayed, you know, 360 degrees, you will begin seeing, and we're deploying now, what we call small cells that are on the side of a building or that are on a lamppost, and it's densifying the network, and that will be an LTE-based solution. And what I tell you, you should expect 5 years from now, if you don't see this, then we have failed. 5 years from now, you as a customer are not going to know, and you are not going to care whether you're on LTE or HSPA Plus or Wi-Fi or AT&T U-verse broadband or your company's VPN client. You're not going to know, and you're not going to care, because it should be seamlessly meshed and moving in and out of there. We're getting closer and closer to this today. I think 5 years is a conservative time frame to achieve that, but that's exactly what's going to be required. The other place that is really critical is when you get to what we call venues. You go to Dallas Cowboy football game. That stadium is lit up like a Christmas tree with Wi-Fi, with LTE, and so forth, because you put 85,000 to 100,000 people in that stadium, everybody is on their device. Everybody is taking pictures. Everybody is looking at stats. In fact, the Super Bowl in Dallas year before last was the first measured experience that we know of where the amount of data going out of the stadium was greater than the amount of data coming into the stadium. Fascinating, right? People are sending more than they're receiving. Densification. And so we're doing all of this in venues and stadiums across the country. It's really changing how you engineer and design the networks.
Bill Goldstein from Fierce Wireless. So going back to the auction, it's tentatively scheduled for next year. Might be pushed potentially to 2015, depending upon what happens. There's obviously a lot that's going to happen or may happen in the market between now and then. Who knows what's going to happen with Sprint, whether SoftBank is going to acquire them or Dish. Clearwire is still kind of up in the air. T-Mobile is integrating Metro PCS's spectrum into their network. They want to use that to expand their LTE capabilities. All that said, they say, you know, we still don't have the kind of low band sub 1 gigahertz spectrum that AT&T and Verizon have. So my question to you is, given that things will likely change significantly from a market and competitive standpoint in terms of those two companies, how do you think that that's going to impact how the FCC looks at how to structure the auction?
Yeah, your point is it's really an important point. Public policy set to pick winners and losers in particular domains in an industry that is moving as quickly as this one is, it's chasing the wind, because you don't know who the competitors are going to be and what those competitors are going to look like by, you said, 2014. If we can pull off this auction and have all of these network providers who want to sell and all these people who want to buy brought in, if we can do all of that, piece together an auction, have the auction performed in 2014, I will be impressed and I will be blown away. And just if you say it's end of 2014 when we're going to do this, you nailed it. We don't even know what the market's going to look like in 2014. And oh, by the way, the market is not sitting still waiting for a 2014 or 2015 auction. The more that the rules seem to be kind of bouncing around and moving, the more the industry and the markets are saying, gee, you know, what should we do today in light of this uncertainty out in the future? And so I think you will see the market itself change in anticipation of an uncertainty that nobody can quite put their fingers on. One of the competitors, as you just said, has said in spite of their massive spectrum holdings, they don't have the low-frequency stuff to compete. They've also said publicly, their CEO, that we have the best spectrum position in the industry. So, you know, you've just got to kind of evaluate all this and ask yourself the question you asked. Do we, as a public policy standpoint, make policy to pick winners and losers in time frames when you don't even know who's going to be the market leader at that time?
Gentlemen, right there.
My name is Eric Garvin. I'm with FTK5. Interesting questions, great comments. Quick question, and that is, how do you see the development of predictive data in terms of the ability to geolocate an individual in the future, and how do you think that you might structure the infrastructure that you build out in order to generate that data, and how much do you think that a customer or user will actually have access to their own data that they generate, in addition to providing it to government agencies and insurance companies and that sort of thing? But how do you see that there might be some mechanism that a customer can actually access the data that they themselves generate over time?
This is a fascinating question. I'll start with geodata, and you asked, how do I see that evolving? I think it's going to be huge. I think it's going to be very significant. I get back to, we better make sure the customer is confident and secure in their geodata, you know, allowing somebody to see where you are at a moment in time. I think the customer has to give those permissions. I don't think it's our permission to give, right? And so I think there needs to be a transparency about this, that the customer knows who, what companies, whether it's Google or AT&T or Facebook or whomever, who is using that geodata and how are they using it. I think that's really, really important. You hit an interesting area, and you're seeing business models begin to develop in the marketplace, and that is, gee, it's my data. You know, why is XYZ company going to make all the money off of my data? Is there some way the customer themselves might be able to monetize their own data and sell it? And you're seeing business models begin to develop that would allow the customer themselves to begin to monetize the data. This is a huge area. In fact, I will tell you, in this industry, the data side of it, big data, as we like to say, is going to be a big driver. It's going to be where a lot of value is created, both for the consumer as well as for companies. I continue to say the amount of investment that's going into these networks, the amount of innovation that's going into all the capabilities, I don't believe all of the returns on this are going to be monetized by sending 100 million customers a bill. I think some amount of this will be monetized by the customers allowing the companies to monetize it to keep their bills lower. Does that make sense? And so to think that, you think about all the investment that's going into all of the infrastructure in the ecosystem, from Silicon Valley to the vendors to the carriers, it's probably illogical to think that an end-user bill will generate the return sufficient to justify the investment. Big data, customers will allow companies to use big data to monetize some of that, I believe. But the key is, I think we as an ecosystem, and I wish the senator were still here, I think from a public policy standpoint, the key is making sure that we have transparency for the customer. He knows how the data is used, and he is giving authorization for the data to be used.
So I know a lot of your current business is in the United States, but does AT&T have any interest in international mergers and acquisitions?
I won't comment on specific M&A. Obviously, I can't, and we don't. But I have been vocal about that there are opportunities outside the United States. And I've spoken to it a bit this morning, and that is, think about how this thing has grown in the United States. The mobile internet revolution, it has been radical. Some would say magical. I mean, it's just been unbelievable what's happened here in the United States. You think about the demographics of the United States. You know, there is another country that has, another region that has comparable demographics. The largest consumer market in the world is Europe. And these technologies, these investments, and these innovations have not yet taken off, and the markets have not yet taken off in Europe. I cannot in my wildest dreams fathom why they will not. I think it is inevitable that they will. Would we like to participate in that? I've said AT&T, we'd love to participate in it. Is it by M&A? I don't know. Is it by we're launching some services here in the United States, Digital Life, that using an all IP, all wireless environment, we're going in and put home monitoring capability into your home. This is an industry that hasn't changed in 30 years. We're going to come in and we're actually in the market now doing this using wireless technology. We can fully equip and monitor your home for a fraction of the cost of what it's cost for about the last 30 years. This is an over-the-top wireless model. Could you deploy that in Europe? As we scale it here in the United States, we're obviously looking at this. Is it transferable? Can it be done in Europe or can it be done in Latin America? We think these are really important opportunities and we're really looking at them closely.
Okay. We are out of time, but I want to thank Randall Stevenson for sharing your views about the future of the industry. Thank you very much for being here.
Appreciate it. Thank you.